As I said, I'm going to keep it quite short. Then we're going to have a talk from Matt about what we can do locally in evangelism and how we can engage in Salisbury. And then we'll have a big Q&A at the end where you can save up all your questions from the whole day and ask all of them. And we can go on as long as you like, but probably not too long. But yeah, there'll be plenty of chance. We've got at least an hour to answer as many questions as we can. So yeah, feel free to do that. We're going to talk a little bit about the main questions in science and religion, because these are ones that come up from time to time. Now, for some people, these won't be the big issues. And I should have said before the last talk, in fact, some of these kind of apologetics questions, questions about science and religion or about the evidence for God or the evidence for the Bible, some of these kind of issues are not actually the issues that are stopping people from believing. It's often very different. And so one of the things I would kind of clarify from the start is, we should never assume that kind of if we just give the evidence, people will be convinced, even if we can give it perfectly, because sometimes it's not a question about the evidence. There could be a huge number of reasons why people are kind of reluctant to put their faith in Jesus. But this is an issue that is, for some people, an issue, and it's something that helps to kind of get rid of as an obstacle for those people who do just think, well, doesn't science just go against Christianity? And for a lot of people, people will have that in the back of their minds, and it's helpful to remove that obstacle gently, just by pointing them to some resources on this or pointing them to some arguments. So we're going to talk a little bit about whether they're in conflict and about how they could be in conflict. Now, for a lot of people, they assume that they must be in conflict, that science and Christianity have to be in conflict with each other, and in a variety of ways, and we'll get to some of those. But there's this kind of idea that's set up for some non-Christians, and also for some Christians, that there's a conflict between them. And if there's a conflict, then we have to choose one. And for non-Christians, that will mean that they have to choose science. And for Christians, sometimes they will say, actually, we should just ignore science in that case and go with what the Bible teaches. But actually, I want to suggest that there's no conflict whatsoever, and that I found this in my own scientific studies doing medicine, studying at med school and doing an undergraduate degree in neuroscience. When I went to medical school, I found actually most of my tutors were Christians. So the head of the medical school was one of my tutors, and he was a Christian. I found this out because one week I went along to chapel in college, and he was giving a talk on the resurrection there. So that was a quite nice surprise. But my history of science tutor, my philosophy of science tutor, and all sorts of other people in the science community in Oxford were Christians. And so I've never had this sense of you can't be a Christian and a scientist. And that is a kind of helpful misconception that we can get rid of if we can say that actually we can believe both. Now, I'm going to try and answer five questions and five areas where they might be in conflict, where people often perceive conflict, and show that actually that conflict doesn't exist. And the first of these is whether scientists can be Christians. And this is something that I think is fairly easy to answer, and actually it's not a conflict that many people think exists. So most people are aware that there are top scientists in history and in the modern world who have been Christians, and who have actually linked their science and their Christianity throughout their work. So in the ancient, well, not the ancient world, but in the pre-modern, or at least not contemporary world, we have a lot of scientific figures. Some of the top scientists in history have been Christians. And this wasn't just accidental. It's not just that they happen to be in a Christian country or they happen to kind of pay lip service to God. Actually, many of these wrote their most profound works on theology and really wrote about God and the importance of theology. So, for example, William of Ockham was a philosopher who wrote all about God for most of his work, but one of his principles has become one of the defining principles of the philosophy of science, that we should go for simple theories rather than complex theories. When it comes to astronomy, Copernicus, Kepler, and Galileo were all Christians, and even though Galileo had an argument with the church, the argument was primarily about politics and not so much about science, and Galileo himself was very clear that he was a Christian. In mathematics, Descartes and Pascal were two Christians, and they were some of the kind of most pioneering mathematical writers before our time. Isaac Newton was a genius at pretty much everything, widely regarded as one of the most genius minds that we've ever seen. And he he regarded his most important works as being his theological works that he'd written. And in genetics, where we get our ideas of DNA, and that actually links into the modern ideas of evolution, Gregor Mendel, who's a kind of hero of Richard Dawkins, was a monk. I think he was Austrian, I'm not sure, but he was a monk and very much devoted to the religious life. So clearly throughout history, there have been scientists who have been happy being Christians and who have seen no conflict. But actually, if we step into the modern day, it's not just because most people were Christians at that time that some of the top scientists were Christians. In fact, some of the top scientists are Christians now, in today's world. And these are people like John Polkinghorne, who was a professor of physics at Cambridge, and who is now an ordained Anglican priest and works kind of both as a retired physicist and as a priest, and does both. Bill Newsom is one of the foremost neuroscientists in the world at Stanford in California. Jennifer Wiseman is one of the kind of foremost scientists at NASA. She often talks about science and faith. John Morris was my professor of anatomy in Oxford and head of the medical school there, who's a Christian, and so on. There are lots of scientist Christians around today. There are lots of Christian scientists as well, but that's not quite the same thing. So clearly, in the kind of pre-modern world, clearly in the modern world, you can be a scientist and a Christian. And you can think that both are fundamentally important to your life. And you can think that the Bible is your main authority, even as a scientist. One of the reasons for this, actually, is because modern science actually has its roots in Christian theology. So Christians actually were pioneers of science partly because they were the ones who saw the universe as ordered by God's rational mind. In the ancient world, one of the things that God did most was to create order. So when we read in Genesis that God created the heavens and the earth, you'll see that in the Genesis narrative, most of what God does isn't actually create ex nihilo. Now Christians, which I mean creates out of nothing. Now Christians do believe that God creates out of nothing. And that's scriptural, and that's part of the theological tradition we have. But it's not what Genesis is mostly talking about. Genesis mostly says that God orders the world and arranges things and puts them in order. Because in the ancient world, to exist was to be ordered. And so they would often talk of disordered things as almost not existing even. That was just a different philosophical way they framed their thoughts. But because of this heritage, because Christians believe that God was a God of order, that God was a God of order and not of chaos, and that God was an intelligent, rational mind, they had a basis for believing that the universe, as the product of a rational, ordered mind, would itself be intelligible and ordered, so that we could study the laws of nature and we could predict what would happen. And these are some of the most fundamental assumptions of science. And these fundamental assumptions of science, that you can't do science without, actually come to us because of the Christian belief of God as an ordered and intelligent mind. And for various other reasons, this kind of outflow of Christian theology worked itself into what has now become modern science. What about the methodology of science and religion? Perhaps the methodology is different, because science says we should base things on evidence and not base things on faith, and religion says we should base things on faith and not on evidence. Is that an accurate picture of what they both believe? You can probably tell by the way I framed the question that I think the answer is no. I think the answer is no, because faith has never been defined in the Christian tradition as believing without evidence. And in fact, the biblical pattern is that people believed of God because of the mighty works that he has done in their lives a lot of the time. They believed in the resurrection because Jesus appeared to them and because he left a tomb empty. And they said, I have faith, I believe. Belief in the New Testament was about what you put your trust in and who you put your trust in. That's what the word faith meant. Having faith in someone meant you put your trust in them. So they would say, I have faith in Caesar. And that doesn't mean they have no evidence for Caesar, but they believe in him anyway. That means they have plenty of evidence for Caesar because they've seen his statues all around the empire. They've perhaps seen him in person. They've seen his officials everywhere. They've seen all the evidence of him, and they think that he's good, and so they put their faith in him. That's what faith meant in their perspective. So when Christians said, we have faith in God, it means they've seen what God has done. They've seen who God has sent. They've seen the image of God in other humans and in Jesus primarily. And they believe because of what they've seen. They believe on the basis of evidence. Now, there are some helpful modern examples that we can kind of just get a better sense of what faith means from. If I look at Usain Bolt, the fastest person in the world, or at least he was a few years ago, setting the 100-meter world record. And I said, I have faith that Usain Bolt is going to win the 100 meters. It's not because I have no evidence that he will do so. I don't believe against the evidence or in spite of the evidence. I believe because I've seen him win it time and time again, because I have a ton of evidence showing that he's the fastest person in the world at 100 meters. So when I say I have faith in him that he will win, it's because I've seen the evidence that he will win. Likewise, this is a famous artist, Justin Bieber. When I say I have faith that Justin Bieber's album will be the best album ever, it's because I've seen evidence that his album will be the best album ever, because I've listened to his albums before and I know how incredible they are. Wasn't intended as a joke, but okay. The point is that evidence is what leads to faith in many cases, and the Christian story is no different. We believe in God because we've seen what God has done, either because we've seen the historical evidence, because we've seen the scientific evidence, because we've seen what God has done in our own lives, because we've seen what God has done in our friends' lives. But we can believe in God because of the evidence, and with the evidence as a support, rather than believing in him in spite of the evidence. So, religion can be supported by that evidence, and we gave some of that evidence in the last talk, so I'm not going to go into that in detail. But the point is that both science and Christianity can base their beliefs on evidence, and both of them challenge us to live accordingly. Both of them say, here's the evidence, this is how you form your beliefs, and then you should live on the basis of those beliefs. The methodology is essentially the same in both cases, only in Christianity it's more important because it's about jumping into a relationship as well as just believing the right things. And this is kind of helpfully summed up by a quote that you might well have heard before. I say that because it appears in virtually every apologetics talk that's ever been given, so I thought I should live up to the expectation. It's C.S. Lewis who says, I have a friend who's a C.S. Lewis PhD scholar in Oxford, and he told me the other day that this is slightly wrong, so don't go and quote it. He said, what it actually says, I think, I believe in Christianity like I believe that the sun has risen. Not because I see it, but because by it I see everything else. So most things in science, including the sun rising, we don't see directly. We have to infer them on the basis of the evidence. Likewise, we don't see God directly, and we don't, in our modern world, see Jesus directly, apart from perhaps a few special visions, which are, I think, quite rare. But we see the evidence, and we see that God makes sense of our experience, just as science makes sense of our experience, and just as the sun makes sense of our experience. So we believe in things because the sun shines on them and illuminates them and makes sense of them. It makes the things we do see explicable and intelligible, and it makes them make sense. And in the same way, although we can't necessarily see God or see Jesus, when we have Christianity as a sort of theory, we can see that it makes sense of everything else in our experience. We can see that it illuminates our experience, and everything that we do see makes sense and fits in light of the Christian story. The next thing I'm going to be talking about is evolution. Now, this is something that obviously has been very debated within churches, very debated within churches all across the world and in different denominations and so on. And I'm perfectly aware, and I've been heckled before, that this is a very divisive topic. And so what I'm not doing is saying you need to believe this, or you're a heretic, or you need to believe this, or you're unscientific. I'm not saying anything like that, and I'm not trying to give a controversial opinion. What I'm just going to do here is to say that for people who believe in evolution, and I will put my cards on the table and say that I am one of them, there are ways that we can understand God's word that do justice both to what we think is the scientific evidence for evolution, and which also do justice to God's word. And I will appreciate here that for some people who take certain scientific facts or who take things which some people think go against the Bible, they do it against the Bible. Some people actually say science and Christianity are in conflict here, and because of that, I'm going to go with science, and so I'm going to change my interpretation of the Bible, or I'm going to reject the Bible. And that is a realistic possibility, and it's something that happens, and it's something that I don't think we should do. So I'm going to just give a general idea of how you could believe in evolution and what the Bible teaches, but in a way that says, this is a way that is authentic to what the biblical teachers were trying to say. And one thing that I think has been helpful in understanding this for me is that Christians have always said throughout the centuries that parts of the early chapters of Genesis are metaphorical. They have always been clear that parts of Genesis are metaphorical and that parts of Genesis are historical. So what I'm not saying is we can just dismiss or turn into metaphor things that we don't like, or that we can dismiss or turn into metaphor things which science shows to be false. I'm saying we should look at the Bible and what it teaches. And if we look at the Bible from an exegetical perspective, looking at the text and looking at what the early church fathers and Christians said about it, we can see that parts of Genesis are intended metaphorically. And we can see this quite easily, I think, by looking at one example in the early chapters of Genesis, where God says, on the day you eat of the fruit of the knowledge of the tree of good and evil, you will die. And when Adam and Eve eat the fruit, on the same day they don't die. They go on to live many hundreds more years. And as Christians, we see that text and we think, well, God doesn't literally mean physical death will happen that day because they didn't physically die that day. We mean God meant some kind of spiritual death, and that's completely right. And all of us can appreciate that there are parts of the story which are symbolic and parts of it which are real. And everyone, no matter how conservative your interpretation of Genesis, no matter how liberal your interpretation of Genesis is, we all agree that some parts are metaphorical. But we can't just turn anything we don't like metaphorical. So here's a way you can think about it that is true to that biblical text and actually retains historical parts, which most Christians have said are historical. Most Christians have said that Adam and Eve exist throughout history. And I wouldn't want to go against that tradition. So I think Adam and Eve were literal historical people. And I think you can make sense of that through the framework of evolution. Now, that might be a kind of joining together or a mechanism or a story that I'm telling that doesn't make sense to you. That's fine. You don't have to agree with what I'm saying. You don't have to agree with what anyone is saying on this. You can come to your own opinion. But I'm just laying out a possibility so that when we can speak to non-Christians, we can say to them, evolution can't be a stumbling block to you believing in Jesus. Even if we disagree about evolution, even if I don't believe in it and you do believe in it, what we can say is, this shouldn't be a stumbling block to you knowing Jesus because you can believe in evolution and what the Bible teaches about Jesus and even what the Bible teaches about Adam and Eve, I think. And I might be wrong, but we can talk about that later if you want to, but just hear me out. I say all of that preliminary notes because the last time I spoke about this, I got heckled. hopefully that won't happen again, but I'd love to speak about it more. So what evolution says is that humans evolved from a common ancestor with other animals, perhaps, and it occurred by natural selection, where that just means humans have or animals have offspring, and those offspring differ slightly, and over a long, long time, the genetic variation in those animals leads to different species, and humans were one of the species that came from that long process. Now, what Christianity is definitely incompatible is with blind evolution. And some scientists say evolution is blind. It's directionless, it's purposeless, it's not going towards anything, and no one designed it. Christianity is clearly incompatible with that because it says God created humans, and God created us for a purpose, and God created us in his image. And any Christian who believes in evolution has to affirm those things, that God did it with a purpose, and God created us in his image. But what we can also see from the Bible is that God created us in his image despite making us from dust. The Bible doesn't kind of say that it doesn't say that humans came about by this kind of explicit divine intervention where he created them out of nothing and sent them into the world from new. The Bible says that God created humans out of dust. It says that we're physical kind of earthy things that God made out of the substance of the earth and made us into people in his image. So God can take the physical world and put his image in it. And in fact, that's what the Bible teaches God is going to do for the whole world. God is going to renew heaven and earth and fill heaven and earth with his glory so that all heaven and earth worships him and all heaven and earth glorifies him. God is going to do that to all of physical creation. And it says God is a kind of starting point, did that with humans. He made humans the central point of that glorification of God and that worship of God by making them in his image. But that's compatible with him making them as physical beings who are made from physical stuff. So I think that's a kind of general picture of how we can understand how is it that God could create humans through evolution and still make them in his image. God is able to do that because he's God, because he's all powerful. And again, if you don't agree with that, I'd love to speak about it more, but that's a possibility for how we can think about this. So we've seen that God can create us still on evolution. The Bible says that God created us, and Christians can't compromise on that. But that doesn't say that the Bible necessarily explains in scientific detail how God created us, because the Bible wasn't given as a scientific textbook. And here's a piece of evidence for that. The Bible says many times that humans think with their gut. Often the word heart that we read in our Bible when people say in their heart or they think in their heart is actually gut in the ancient Hebrew. And the reason it says this is because in the ancient world, it was just common knowledge that humans believed and thought and had their cognition in their gut. So the Bible isn't trying to give scientific information. It's talking in the language of the time, saying we think in our gut, just because that's what people believed at the time. But it's not intending to give us scientific information, telling us that people think with their guts. God knows that we think with our brains. And in the same way, sometimes the Bible, although it relies on a common knowledge in the ancient world, or what they thought was common knowledge, or common language, or idiom, it's not trying to make a scientific point. So much of the Genesis story is not necessarily, or at least we're not bound to think this as Christians, that God is trying to tell us a scientific story about how humans were created. Likewise, God says that he gives us our daily bread. And yet Christians can still believe that he does this through a mechanism. God gives us our daily bread, but he does it through agriculture. He makes the rain happen. He makes the plants grow. He allows us to carry out the work that's needed to make bread from plants. But God gives us our daily bread. The fact that it happens through a scientific or a physical process is completely compatible with God doing it. Adam and Eve, this is one of the things that I think most people struggle with. And I want to say, as I clarified at the start, you can believe in evolution and believe in Adam and Eve. And evolutionists and Christians have tried different ways of making this work. And none of them make sense of everything. None of them are kind of airtight. None of the answers in general in this debate are completely airtight. There are always things that will be unresolved. But actually, there are some possibilities for believing in Adam and Eve and evolution. One of those possibilities is that Adam and Eve were the first people who God revealed himself to in a special way and called into relationship and called to spread his message. And we know that Adam and Eve failed to do that. They turned away from God and they said, we will not represent you to the world and we will not represent the world to you. We will not bear your image by showing how good you are to the rest of the world. And we will not sum up creation's praise and worship you. God called them to do that and they didn't do it. And it might be that Adam and Eve were the first people who God specifically called to do that. One reason you might think this is because in the New Testament, where Paul talks about Adam and Eve and talks about Jesus, he says that Adam was the first man. And for some people, they think this kind of shows evolution to be false because there were humans before Adam. But if we look at the text, I'm not saying if we look at science, I'm saying if we look at the biblical text, we see Paul says Adam was the first man and Jesus was the second man or the last man. What Paul is saying there is not Jesus was the second man to ever exist, because on the literal picture, Jesus wasn't the second man to ever exist. It was Cain or Abel. I forget which one comes first. Nor was Jesus the last man to exist. There are plenty of us who have existed after Jesus, and Jesus was, in fact, in a sense, existing before all of them. So when Paul says Adam was the first man and Jesus was the last man, he's not saying these are literally the first and the last or the first and the second people in existence. He's saying this is the first significant person as part of God's story of redeeming humankind. And Jesus is the last or the second person who is significant or especially significant in God's story of redeeming humans. And so Paul is not making a scientific point about which man came in which order and how many men there were in the world. He's saying this is the start of God's story with Adam. This is the end of God's story with Jesus. And he's making that point about how Jesus overcame and turned over Adam's sin. So that's how we can kind of understand some of the New Testament points. Now, there's much more that could be said about this. There's a load more that could be said about evolution, whether it fits with the Bible, whether it fits with Genesis, whether it makes sense scientifically, and I don't have time to go into all of that. But hopefully this gives you some idea of how you can have a really authentic, faithful, conservative interpretation of the text that says, actually, there is a lot of history in it. Adam and Eve really existed, and we can't just dismiss that. And obviously, there are parts that are symbolic as well, as has been recognized by the biblical authors, as has been recognized by the church since long before the theory of evolution, as has been recognized by virtually everyone in Christian history, including very conservative scholars today. There are parts of it that are metaphorical. But the point is that if we read it faithfully, and if we read it as a generally authentic, authoritative scripture, there are still ways that we can make sense of it in light of what appears to be the leading theory in contemporary science, the theory of evolution. As I said, there's much more that could be said about that, but that's just a general picture of how you might link the two if that's something that you find is a stumbling block for non-Christians. And I hope that makes sense. Now we're over the controversial bit. The next bit is about Jesus' resurrection, which all of us believe in. So it's great news. Miracles. What about miracles? Some people say that Christianity is anti-science because they believe in miracles. And what science says is that miracles can't happen. Science says that there are laws of nature which aren't violated, and Christianity says the laws of nature are violated. Which of them is right? Surely there's a conflict here. In fact, I think when we think about the concept of miracle, and when we think of what Christians are actually saying and what we're actually claiming, there's not an incompatibility here. What you can think of is a miracle as a one-off event. The only sense in which miracles break the laws of nature is that miracles go against what normally happens. God invented the laws of nature, and so God can go against the laws of nature if he wishes. The laws of nature just describe what normally happens when science or nature is left to itself without outside intervention. But scientists often believe in one-off events. They often believe things that have no parallel in the rest of history. They often believe in things that never happened again in the rest of history. How is this the case? Well, they believe in things like the origin of the human race. They say that humans only ever exist, they only began to exist once. The human race began to exist at one particular point. Scientists say the Big Bang happened at one particular point and has never happened again since. Scientists believe in lots of things that we've never seen, never witnessed, and that have never happened again. They just say this happened as a one-off event completely uniquely. But in the same way, Christians say that that's true of the resurrection of Jesus. They say Jesus was raised from the dead, and perhaps no one has been raised in the same way as him. People have certainly been resuscitated in miraculous healings like Lazarus, but they haven't had the same resurrection that Jesus had. This is a one-off event, just in the same way that the Big Bang was a one-off event. So the question is, why is it that scientists sometimes believe in one-off events? And if we can get a handle on that, we can get a handle on why we can believe as Christians in miracles, which are other one-off events. And here's a way you might think about it that hopefully will make some sense. Scientists believe in one-off events because they say, although normally we have a set of laws that normally operate, in some circumstances, that set of laws doesn't operate, not because it's violated, but because there's a deeper, more fundamental law going on beneath it. A really helpful example here is with Newtonian mechanics. I say it's a really helpful example, knowing that some of you will be a little bit alarmed by that. Newtonian mechanics is quite simple. It literally just describes how objects normally move around. It says that when I push this lectern, it will push me with the same force, kind of in the opposite direction. It says that things are attracted to each other by gravity, that they bounce off each other. It's essentially basic physics, that when you push things, they fall over, that when you put forces on things, they move, that sort of thing. And scientists for many centuries thought that this was the whole story of physics, that this was a virtually complete account of physics. They would say these are the laws of nature. But then in the 20th century, they found that actually these are not the laws of nature. And it's not because they suddenly started believing in miracles or ghosts or demons or anything like that. It's because they said, actually, there's a more fundamental law beneath Newtonian mechanics, our kind of basic laws of physics, that explains the laws of physics, but also explains that in some circumstances, some very special circumstances, which we can't easily replicate, something different happens at the extreme ends of reality. So they say, normally the world works this way, with these laws of nature that we recognize. But sometimes things break what seem to be the laws of nature because there's an underlying, more fundamental law that explains all of it. It explains why we normally have our normal laws of nature, but it explains at the same time why at the end of reality, the extreme end of reality, something else happens which seems to break the laws of nature. So scientists are completely open to that. They say sometimes we have events which seem to break the normal laws of nature, but it's because there's a deeper explanation going on. And they believe that those extreme events or those things which seem to break the laws of nature are worth believing in for two reasons. Firstly, because there's a fundamental law which explains them. And secondly, just when there's very good evidence for it. So they say the Big Bang only happened once because they can give a theory which explains the Big Bang and why it's never happened again, and also because they say there's good evidence for the Big Bang. But when we use these same principles, we can see that the same is true for the resurrection, for example. When we look at Jesus' rising from the dead, we find that the same principle is there. That normally the laws of nature are in existence and in operation because God keeps them in operation. But at the extreme end of reality, there's a deeper law which explains firstly why people normally stay dead, but why also in one particular case, someone didn't remain dead and rose from the dead. And Christians say that deeper law is that God created the universe in a regular way, but that he does miracles to reveal himself to us. And he picks particular times to do miracles that will reveal himself most fully and most accurately. And he did this to Jesus because Jesus was the revelation of God. So we can explain the more fundamental law of why Jesus would be raised from the dead, and yet no one else has been raised from the dead in the same way. Because the story that Christianity tells a story of a deeper law, where God loves us and creates a world that has been corrupted by sin and exposed to death, but God has sent Jesus as a particular person and in a particular time and place to break those laws as part of a deeper law, which is the law of God's love and God's story in redeeming humanity. The second part of the story of why scientists believe in unique events is just about the evidence. Now, I've given some of that evidence in the previous lecture. You could also talk about the evidence for Jesus' resurrection in particular. And this evidence I found is very convincing. This is the evidence that convinced me to be a Christian. So the historical evidence for Jesus' resurrection in particular is very compelling. And 2,000 years later, historians still have found no other way to explain the empty tomb, and the appearances to his disciples. 2,000 years later, we have no better explanations. In fact, our explanations are worse than 2,000 years ago when it comes to explaining the empty tomb and the appearances to the disciples. So a Christian can base their belief in Jesus' resurrection, firstly, on the evidence for it, and secondly, on the fact that it isn't just a random breaking of a law of nature. It's part of a more fundamental law, which is God's story of his meeting humanity and revealing himself to humanity in a particular time and place. So finally, I'm just going to talk about, for probably about 5 minutes, and then we'll wrap up. 5 minutes about why Christianity or why God's existence can actually help to make sense of science. So we've talked about areas where Christianity and science might be in conflict. We've talked about areas where people think there's a kind of tension between them. But actually, I want to go further. I don't want to just say there's no tension or conflict between them. I want to say science actually points towards God. And it does this in at least two ways. The first of these ways is that physicists in the last 30 years or so have found that the universe had to be insanely special for humans to exist. It had to be insanely special even for chemistry and atoms to exist. If, for example, if the strength of gravity was a tiny bit stronger, then the universe would collapse in on itself and humans wouldn't be able to exist. If the strength of gravity was a tiny bit weaker, the universe would expand too quickly and no humans would be able to exist. Not even complex chemistry or physics or atoms or anything like that. You couldn't have life. And that is what God says that he wants. He wants life and relationship. But the probabilities here are actually astounding. It's not just that if the universe was a bit stronger or a bit, if gravity was a bit stronger or a bit weaker, life wouldn't exist. But physicists have actually quantified this to some extent. And they've said the chance of getting gravity at this exact level, from all the possible strengths it could be, the chance of striking lucky with this strength of gravity is 1 in 10 to the power of 60, which is 1 in billions and billions and trillions and zillions. It's 1 in 10 with 60 zeros after it. That is a minuscule probability. That's less than the probability of you winning the lottery millions of times in a row. It's an absolutely staggering improbability. The universe is that special. And physicists have found this is not just the case with gravity, but with all sorts of laws in physics. If they were just a tiny bit different, life would not exist. And this is a problem that plagues physicists. And many of them say this is something that needs explanation, even if they don't explain it with God. So they say maybe there are just billions and billions of universes, and they all have different laws so that one of them gets lucky. That's the kind of thing they say to explain these kind of coincidences. But Christianity, I talked earlier about how C.S. Lewis says Christianity makes sense of our experience. It illustrates what we experience and makes it intelligible. Well, God makes this phenomenon intelligible. Because if God exists, we can easily see why the universe would be so special. Because God is a God of love and relationship who wants to create life so that he can enjoy relationship with it. And yet, if God doesn't exist, this is just an immense coincidence. There's no intelligibility of this phenomenon at all. We can't make any sense of it. And so this points towards God because it's something that fits perfectly within the Christian picture, but that is completely surprising and coincidental and difficult to explain if God doesn't exist. Likewise, a second example, the order of the universe. I said earlier that modern science came about because Christians believed that the universe was ordered because they believed that God was a God of order and not a God of chaos. Now, in fact, this assumption that science is regular and that the laws of nature are regular is actually a phenomenal assumption. It's something that scientists just take for granted. They never try to explain it. They just assume that it's true. But it's actually an immense coincidence. So suppose outside you saw a red car going past. You would think that's no coincidence. If you saw a second red car going past, you think, okay, the chances of that are maybe 1 in 10. Still not a great coincidence. If you saw 1,000 red cars going past in a row, you would think, that is a bit of a strange coincidence that there would be such a pattern, that the same thing would happen 1,000 times in a row. It needs an explanation. Now, the explanation might be quite mundane. The explanation might be quite boring. It might be quite simple. But you don't just say, that's just a coincidence. It doesn't need an explanation. This kind of order and patterning, this kind of immensely improbable coincidence needs an explanation. And yet, when we think about the laws of the universe, it's an immense coincidence. Because scientists say that the same laws of nature hold for millions and millions of years. Every time you do the exact same thing to an atom over millions of years, it will have the same reaction. And it will have the same reaction throughout the observable universe for billions and billions of light years. The fact that the same thing would happen throughout all time and all space is an immense coincidence. It's the coincidence that if we saw it going past on the road, if it was just 1,000 red cars, we would say, that needs an explanation. But this coincidence is much, much bigger. It's for the entire universe for eternity. And that is a coincidence that needs explanation. And Christians have said this makes perfect sense if God exists, because God is a God of order. But if God doesn't exist, we have no answer. We haven't even tried to give an answer. Scientists just take it for granted. So it's something that Christianity makes sense of, but otherwise is completely unintelligible. And so again, it points to God. Now, how did the biblical authors think about this? They actually said the steadfastness of nature is something that does point to God. They recognize this. They said that the fact that the same thing happens, that they can rely on agriculture, they can rely on their kind of basic laws of nature and science that they had discovered. They said this points towards God. And so they say, the steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. His mercies never come to an end. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. And then and again in Hosea, it says, come, let us return to the Lord. He has torn us to pieces, but he will heal us. He has injured us, but he will bind up our wounds. After 2 days, he will revive us. On the third day, he will rescue us, that we may live in his presence. Let us acknowledge the Lord. Let us press on to acknowledge him. And what is the guarantee of this? The guarantee is, as surely as the sun rises, he will appear. He will come to us like the winter rains, like the spring rains that water the earth. The steadfastness of nature, the order of nature, the laws of nature were always intended to point us to the steadfast love of God. And yet we find the alternative story where God doesn't exist can't make any sense of this. It can't explain this fundamental assumption of science. And Christianity has said, we've had the answer all along. The reason science is possible and we have the laws of nature is because God has put them there. Because God is a reliable God on whom we can depend and in whom we can put our trust. And that's the story that we can tell when we're talking about science to our friends who are scientifically inclined. So I hope that's been helpful for you. And we're going to hand over to Matt now for local evangelism tips. But thank you again so much for listening.